good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you guys are listening to this podcast. So welcome back to Teachable Psych, and thank you for choosing to listen to this today, and I hope you guys enjoy this month's guest speaker. It's coming all the way from Texas A&M Commerce University, from Dr. Tracy Henley, and I hope you guys enjoy it. Would you like to start by introducing yourself?
My name is Dr. Tracy Henley. I am currently on the faculty at Texas A&M University Commerce. What else would you like to know?
I think that's good. Okay. So, do you have any personal experiences with psychology and education?
Yes. I came into my present position in 2003. To be the head of the department here. And the program here has a PhD in that area, cognition instruction, psychology and education, educational psychology, ever how you'd like to phrase it. Since I have been here in Texas, that's been the focus of our doctoral program. And I have taught several courses in the in that program, in that general area. So I do have some background in educational psychology.
Okay. So what's your take on how psychology is related to education?
Well, that's a good question. And let me give you maybe a historical answer. I think that when psychology first began as an academic university-based enterprise, certainly one of the areas that it had as a focus, or that was one of the first places that people saw a utility and a use for it, was precisely in the area of education, because psychology purported to be about mental phenomena like learning and memory and motivation, things of that nature, all of which are clearly related to education. The history of the two is pretty tightly associated. You can find in the late 1800s, several of the first schools that were offering courses in psychology. Many of those in Germany had courses that were tied to what they call pedagogy, which is essentially a 25-cent word in that context for education. So there's one answer.
Okay. So what do you think is the number one problem for teachers and students, and how they get attention and retain it for an extended amount of time?
Well, and again, the people have been interested in this for a long time. I think something I would recommend to you, if you want to dig a little deeper into the connection between psychology and education, there's a wonderful series of talks that were turned into a little short book called Talks with Teachers by William James that was published around the turn of the last century. So it's more than, it's about 120 years old. But certainly that... Your question brings that to mind, because that was certainly one of the things that his audience asked him, and one of the things that even 100 plus years ago people were interested in is, you know, how do you get students engaged? How do you get them involved? You know, to some degree you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. In part, some of this, you know, it has to be understood as the responsibility of the student and not just the teacher. You could have the most gifted teacher in the world and the best materials and resources, but if the student just doesn't want to be there, if the student doesn't care, I'm not sure there's anything the teacher could do. I do think we have to acknowledge that some chunk of this, again, lies with the student themselves. But assuming that the student has showed up with an interest in being educated, an interest in learning something that day, there are lots of tricks and tips, some of them based in psychology, some of them just based in modern education techniques, or, you know, trying to engage people's attention, to maintain their attention. But one of the things that James points out in that essay is that, you know, we do have to be careful that we don't confuse education with entertainment. You know, that we while it is important that, and it's probably good that people are having fun while they're learning, and it's important that they, you know, be engaged, and that we attempt to make that contact and maintain that contact. We can't let kind of that focus on engagement and entertainment take up all of our time, or then we don't become very efficient in terms of actually teaching somebody anything new.
So, do you think you'd teach differently if you didn't have a degree or background in psychology?
Well, that's a great question. It is a great question. I've never thought about that. I'm sure that, when I started, I was doing social cognitive work, so I wasn't doing really education work. And certainly there are a lot of people who teach college who don't have a background in psychology. They have a background in English or math or PE or whatever it is their degree's in. I'm sure that I would have a certain style, and it would be very similar, I suppose, to what it is now if I was not in psychology, or certainly didn't know anything about kind of psychology and education. But yeah, I can't imagine that that I don't apply some of those things. I'm sure that I do in a conscious way. So I am sure that being trained as a psychologist, and in the 20 years I've been in Texas, being exposed to kind of educational psychology even more than I had been earlier, that those things do have some impact on how I go about teaching class. But that's a great question.
Thank you. So, for people that are an educator or just in the school system, do you think they should at least get a bachelor's in psychology to help with just interactions with students?
I think that's another good question. That's probably not realistic, but it is the case that most degrees in education do have a decent number. I don't know. I'm sure it varies from school to school, but I'm going to guess probably at least a half dozen or so courses that are usually offered by psych departments that are required for their degree in education. So at most universities, for example, students have to take a developmental psych class, probably at least one learning class, maybe more, maybe a cognitive class. These days, typically, they're also going to be exposed to something like a social diversity class. They're probably going to get exposed to around six. And again, I'm sure some schools it's a little more, a little less, psych classes, which is not quite as many as you'd get for a minor, but it's, you know, it's in that ballpark. So I do think that there are, there's a lot of people who go ahead and complete a minor in psychology, because typically for a college degree, you have to have a major and a minor. So if they're an education major, I think a lot of those people are also psych minors. I think it probably does serve them very well. we get we see a lot of students at our university who have an undergraduate degree in education, and at some point they want to come back and work on a master's. And many of those people will take their electives or, again, do their minor work in our department, because I think that they also have learned via their practical experiences that knowing facts about psychology helps them manage hard cases in terms of behavior, helps them deal with emotional issues, as well as, again, the nuts and bolts of learning and motivation and memory and all of those sorts of things.
So does your degree in psychology give you a different perspective on people and or people and or on yourself?
Oh, I think probably more the latter. I started life in a philosophy department. I actually, my undergraduate degrees, I have a double major in philosophy and psychology, and I worked on a graduate degree in philosophy at the master's level before I did a PhD in psychology. So, you know, I would say that both the philosophy and the psychology, you know, can give you some insights into being introspective, into you know, trying to, I don't know, live authentically and more inwardly directed, but certainly the psychology part, you know, I started off academically, not as an educational psychologist, but doing what's called social cognition. So how we communicate with language, you know, how our attitudes get changed, how groups impact us, and knowing those sorts of things, yeah, it's easy to look around and kind of see the consequences of those sorts of big effects on people. Certainly having been trained as a psychologist, it does impact the way I look at others more so than myself. I suspect it was my training in philosophy that makes me reflect sometimes on my own behaviors.
So if you were to conduct a research on how psychology can, like, help education, how would you conduct it?
Well, that's quite broad. I mean, there are lots and lots of people doing studies in that ballpark even as we speak today. So there's a huge literature on all kinds of ways that psychology and education can intersect, and that psychology can be a benefit to education. I suppose if I were to think about what kind of educational research I've done, it would, again, more nuts and boltsy kind of stuff in terms of, I have been part of some published work that of animals. One way I could do that would be to literally just give them a list of animal names. Another way I could do that would be to give them a sheet where they could read the animal names. I could give them pictures. But the idea of this kind of multiple modality is, let's see if we can mix and match all of these sorts of things, so that we're pairing a picture, maybe even a video, with, you know, the hearing the name, seeing or reading the name. So we're hitting multiple modalities at once. We're getting kind of the eyes, the ears, the reading components all going at once. And in general, what you find is that up to about three or four, the more modalities you can involve, especially for school-age children, the more, probably the better, the better the learning outcome is going to be. So if I just give them a worksheet or a video, if I just give them one of those things, probably not as good if I compare them together. But you can do too much. So like I said, something around 3 or 4 is probably optimal. You don't necessarily, for example, need to have them touching, you know, something to feel what the animal's fur is like, or having something olfactory to smell what the animal would be like. You can wind up making that a little too big. So there's you an example of a little bit of real work I've done.
I'm sorry. So could you like go over the beginning, because it got cut off?
Oh, okay. Where did you lose me?
Like right when you started talking about it.
Let me see if I can paraphrase and just say that one of the concrete examples of something that I've done is to look at using multiple sensory modalities as a way to enhance learning. And again, the research shows that if I just say show somebody a picture, or if I just have them read something, or just have them listen to something, that's not as effective as if I can kind of mix and match all of those and engage those multiple modalities.
Do you think that's why some people prefer videos to help them study?
Maybe. I think that people certainly develop habits and preferences that they believe, and that's maybe the most important thing that I'll say here, they believe is beneficial to their learning. The fact that they believe it does not always make it true. For example, there are people who will tell you, oh, I've got to be listening to music while I study, or I can only study if I'm with my friends, or, you know, I can only study if it's already after 9 o'clock, or, you know, they come up with all of these little beliefs based upon, and in some cases maybe they are accurate, but there's a lot of evidence that would show that just because that's what they prefer doing and they've convinced themselves that they need to be doing it that way, that it's not necessarily the case. They might in fact be even better if they were doing it by themselves without music at 8 a.m. So
how do you think psychology and education has progressed throughout history?
Well, I think that, you know, psychology over, when psychology first entered into being a recognized academic discipline, it was largely what we would now think of as cognitive psychology, and, you know, with interest on things like attention and memory and perception. And it very much aspired to be a science of the mind. I think psychology has continued along that perspective. It has always had a little bit of an uphill battle, in that pretty much everybody, because they do perceive, they do attend, they do learn, they are motivated, kind of thinks of themselves as an armchair expert, even if they have no formal training, which is very different than, say, chemistry or physics, right? I mean, people who don't have any training in chemistry or physics don't tend to think that they really know something about it. Mm-hmm. But because all of us have kind of lived experience with, again, groups and learning and thinking and motivation, we all kind of feel like we're armchair psychologist, and that maybe we're pretty sharp with down that line, and that's been hard for psychology, because like I said, it makes it very different than chemistry or biology or physics, where not everybody and their brother kind of feels like they their opinion should count, or that they have some special expertise. I think the history of psychology has been very positive. Like I said, it started out aspiring to be a science. It's continued down that road. I think it's continued to gain the respect of the other sciences, and in general, the respect popular culture, people in general. You know, it still has a ways to go, but I think it's moving in the right direction. Education, education's maybe a little different. I mean, people have been educating each other for forever, first informally and then eventually more formally. Theories of education can differ quite a bit across cultures. You know, what people believe is best practices in Northern Europe is not necessarily the same as in parts of Asia, as in parts of the United States. So people can take pretty radically different approaches to education. It is not the sort of thing that's conducive to being a science in the same way. You know, again, it is because it's something we do with all of our children, so it impacts so many people, and we do it kind of in most countries. We do it on the budget and on the, out of the pocketbook of taxpayers and under the auspices of the government. You know, it gets caught up in a lot of theory, a lot of social theory, a lot of politics with a lowercase p kind of theory about kind of what should be best practices, and those are not always able to be determined scientifically then.
So it says on the Texas A&M Commerce website that you like to create tabletop games. If you if you haven't already, is there something that you would create that could help students?
I think in general that games are underappreciated as having a lot of educational impact. I've been interested in games and education since before I came to Texas. As a matter of fact, just before I came to Texas, I had a couple of big grants with the National, with the Department of Education and the National Science Foundation to develop games to try to help teach middle school kids kind of ratio mathematics. I also worked on several other projects where we were trying to leverage games to teach people at different ages different things. I think just in general, even if you're not directly trying to teach somebody a given thing, I think that most good games do develop useful skills, cognitive skills. You know, people need to develop some strategy. They need to learn some tactics. They need to, you know, to be able to evaluate options. They need to, again, be able to pay attention to what's going on around them at a social cognitive level to try to figure out if somebody's bluffing or things of that nature. There's just virtually every sort of tabletop game has practical skills built into it. So I'm very bullish on games, even if they're not directly educational games, even if they're just purely entertainment. I think that they are excellent tools for building cognitive skills.
Thank you.
And I'm not a video game hater. Don't misunderstand me. But I do think that oftentimes, you know, if you're playing just a fast twitch shooter or something like that, you know, I'm not sure there's a lot of cognitive skills involved. But, you know, whether you're playing card games, board games, role-play games, virtually any sort of tabletop game, you're probably engaging some useful cognitive skills.
Okay. So
what about you? Are you a gamer?
No, not really.
No, not at all?
I mean, like, the thing I've played the most recently is Mario Kart with friends.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So I've seen that you're an author of many books. What got you to start writing them? I asked, what got you to start writing books? Can you hear me now?
I can. Okay. And now yep.
Okay, I asked, what got you to start writing books?
I guess that's another good question. The very first book I did was on William James, who I had mentioned earlier in the context of his talks with teachers. And I guess what got me started with that first book was James was somebody who me and at least some other people I knew really still appreciated, even though by the time I was doing this, he basically had been dead for 100 years. And you don't necessarily think about somebody in any kind of scientific discipline being, I mean, we may respect them and we may want to kind of, you know, pay homage to them if they're historical figures, but we don't necessarily think of too many people in science who died 100 years ago still being that relevant. Mm-hmm. And but I had a sense that James had a lot of insights that that were still very relevant and were very relevant to current research. And so the first book I did was to put together a collection of authors. It was an edited anthology where each chapter is by somebody different. And having them just, you know, if they agreed, then they wrote the chapter. Obviously, if they didn't agree, I guess they wouldn't have written the chapter. But that there was something kind of really still relevant today and that people needed to be reminded of. So that was my first book and how I got started. Many of my books have been textbooks, mostly in the history of psychology. That's kind of my special interest, my special love. Again, like I said, I started in philosophy and psychology kind of grows out of philosophy, so I've always been interested in that. And then my last couple of books have been looking at psychology and prehistory. Something I've kind of gotten interested in is kind of juxtaposing or combining psychology with archaeology. There was a movement in archaeology that started about 20 years ago, really trying to use more psychology to interpret finds. What does a particular, you know, village layout mean? What does this, you know, this artwork on this cave potentially mean? And there's a handful of psychologists who were kind of interested in working with the archaeologist, and that's something that I got into, I don't know, maybe not quite 10 years ago, but six, eight years. And that's kind of what I've been doing in the last 5 or 10 years is mostly working in that area.
So my next question was actually going to be about your most recent book. Could you tell us a little bit what it's about?
Yeah, I had one that came out in November of this last year. It is exactly as I just said, about trying to align psychology and archaeology. It's another book where I invited a number of colleagues to contribute a chapter. So it moves across topics, psychological topics, talking about kind of how they can potentially intersect with archaeology and the prehistory, even before the ancient world. I myself am especially interested in the earliest sites where for a long, 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 long time in human prehistory, we were what are called hunters and gatherers, and we basically lived in small groups, 50 to 75, and we were pretty much constantly mobile. We'd probably follow animal herds, or we would go on these circuits where we knew at certain times of the year there'd be nuts growing here, fruit trees here, fish available here. And so we lived in these small groups and these highly mobile small groups, and we would follow these natural resources. But at some point, we shifted and we started building structures and walls and farms and towns and villages. And I'm kind of fascinated by the whole reason, because I think it was psychological in part that we shifted that lifestyle, and how that shift in lifestyle then has impacted our psychology. Not just our social psychology, but that's certainly near the top of the list.
All right, thank you. And thank you so much for taking time out of your day for this interview.
Well, I am pleased to have helped you. Now, before we go, a couple of things. How did you find me? Maybe you told me that and I forgot, but...
Obviously, I needed to find professors to interview, so I looked for professors in psychology, and I was like, why don't I look at colleges in Texas, since my mom's side of the family's in Texas? So, like, maybe I'll go there one day. You never know.
All right. Well, that sounds good. We would absolutely be delighted if you would be interested in attending our university. And there are lots of other excellent universities in Texas. No, that's simple enough. And the other thing I had mentioned to you, and again, I'm happy to help, but if you want me to, I can send you as an email suggestions for some. I've got a colleague in New Mexico, who's just starting out, but he's at New Mexico Highlands University. But I think he'd be really good for this, because he also he does a podcast, and I know a couple of other folks. If you're interested in wanting to talk to any more psychologists, I'd be happy to send you some other names.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you so much.
All right. Is there anything else I can do to be of service?
No, that would be all for today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. You have a great day.
Thank you, too. Bye. Bye. Hi, guys, and welcome back. I hope you guys enjoyed today's guest speaker, and I hope you learned something new, because I definitely did. And, yeah, I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your day and week, and that you can continue listening to this, and that you enjoy it. And, yeah. Have a good day.